Welcome to Access Utah. Art has captured the historical record of science through time. Today on the program, tonight's Science Unwrapped speaker, Dr. Laura Gelfand, head of Utah State University's Department of Art and Design, discusses science in prominent works of art, particularly during the Renaissance period. At 9:30, Science Questions guides you through the steps of how to launch a rocket into outer space with the private aerospace company ATK, based in northern Utah. Then Science Questions presents current satellite research and a student-driven project in space that was developed at USU's Space Dynamics Lab. This coming up, stay tuned.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan, now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. Artists captured a historical record of science. It is particularly evident during the Renaissance, when painters began to depict the natural world. Today on the program, tonight's Science Unwrapped speaker, Dr. Laura Gelfand, head of USU's Department of Art and Design, talks about the depictions of science in prominent works of art. She grew up in Salt Lake City, and as she left, her passion for art and education ignited.
It actually started when I left. I studied abroad when I was in college, probably my freshman into sophomore year. I went and I studied in Italy, and I was living in Siena and Florence, and we would have a class, an art history class in the classroom one day, and then the next day we would actually go see the works of art, and I just fell for it. It was just the most perfect thing for me. And so ever since probably that freshman, sophomore year, I came back. I declared art history my major, despite all of my what my parents thought about that, and then went all the way through. So I was I studied art history in Massachusetts, where I got my master's at Williams College, and I actually finished up my undergraduate degree at Stony Brook in New York, and then I got my PhD at Case Western Reserve in Cleveland, and then bounced around teaching art history from there on.
Of course, there were challenges along the way, but her parents did have a change of heart about her chosen profession.
As soon as it was clear that I was totally committed to doing it and that I was going to be successful because I was going to work really hard, they were fine with it. And that was great. They were always really supportive and fantastic about it. And I don't know, in terms of challenges, you know, I think one of the things that's probably most challenging for art historians who do what I do, because I study European art, is just finding ways to get to Europe enough to do the research that you need to do. Because there's, you know, there are not a lot of grant opportunities for us. There are not a lot of funding sources. And so, you know, finding ways to get to where you need to be to get to those sources is always a challenge. And I see that with the art historians that are in my department currently. So it's something that I'm really aware of and work on for them as well.
Every art historian has an area they focus on, according to Gelfand. And for her, it is Northern Renaissance, art created in Northern Europe.
And my focus is from about 1400 to about 1520. 1530 is about as late as I go. I have worked a little bit earlier, and there was a period of time in which I was really kind of bridging into medieval art. So working a little bit earlier, it's interesting because the Northern Renaissance, as opposed to the Italian Renaissance, you really can kind of see traces of the Middle Ages much more. It's much more apparent in the Northern Renaissance than it is in the Italian Renaissance. And it's an interesting kind of transition there that happens in the difference between the North and the South. So for me, I mean, I'm very, very passionate about Northern and really Italian Renaissance as well. But I think the Northern material is so fantastic. So for my talk on Friday, I've been thinking about how to share what I'm really passionate about in art history with a larger group. And I know that Science Unwrapped brings in all sorts of people, people from the community, people from the university. It's this really mixed group from everything that I've heard. So trying to give a talk that is not highly, highly technical, but deals with some of the technical aspects of what art history really is, it's been a real challenge to put that together. And it's been a lot of fun. It's actually kind of caused me to break away from my job as a what seems like a full-time administrator and to really throw myself into being an art historian again and think about what it is that I like so much about that and how to share that with people.
She will be sharing her knowledge tonight at the opening of USU's Science Unwrapped Fall Series called Nature's Ancient Stories. Dr. Gelfin will present Lights, Canvas, Action at 7 in the Eccles Science Learning Center.
So what I thought I'd do is kind of take one particular painting, and it's a painting that some people know, some people don't. It's really famous, but, you know, a lot of people don't know the history of art, and why would they, you know? So, but it's a work that in my field is super huge, and it's in the National Gallery, and it's called the Arnolfini Portrait, and it has inspired reams of art historical writing. There are at least three separate complete books on just this one painting. There are countless essays. There is just countless material out there about this painting, and everyone has worked on it for a very long time, and there's a sort of mystery to it. And so one of the things I'm going to do is take people through the process of how do you look at a picture, and how would an art historian, and how have art historians tried to figure out what's going on with those pictures. So one of the things that we do, especially in Northern Renaissance, because our paintings are actually typically on panel, is that they are x-rayed. And there's a way to x-ray them where you can see the artist working underneath the paint surface and see what their original drawing looks like. And so I'm going to show images of that. So you can see the changes that Jan van Eyck made, the artist that we'll be talking about, as he went through the process of finishing that painting, because it's really interesting to see that. We'll talk a little bit about perspective and how the artist is creating perspective and what kind of perspective it is, because it isn't really sort of classic one-point perspective. It's something else. And so we'll talk about that. There are lots of things I rejected, like I thought I could bring in images. We do these sort of tiny paint samples of the paint on a panel and look at the layers, and you can actually break down chemically what the artist is doing there. But I always find those kind of hard to look at, so I'm going to spare the audience stuff like that. But really talk a little bit about where the painting has been, what its history tells us about it, and then what we can understand about our own selves and what our interpretations are and have been and how those change through time by looking at the way basically scholars have looked at it from about 1516 to the present. So it's a kind of wide open talk and pretty wide ranging, but it all comes back to this sort of one picture and what can you do with one picture as an art historian.
Dr. Gelfin explains why Jan van Eyck's paintings have inspired so much in-depth scrutiny.
It's an unusual image, and it's funny. It's I think part of the reason that the Arnolfini portrait has attracted so much attention is because in some ways it's a unique image. And in art history, unique images are always problematic. You know, you have a million images of the Virgin and Child, and you pretty much know what's happening in an image like that. A million images of the crucifixion. But when you have a picture like this where you have this very highly detailed interior. And the thing about Jan van Eyck that is so much fun, there are all these kind of, you know, we don't really know him. He lived from about 1380 to 1440. He died in 1441. And he supposedly was the inventor of oil painting, but we know that that's not true because various people were experimenting with it. His work is so highly detailed that people, that when they describe him, like early people will describe that he painted with a single mouse hair in his brush. And that's a very funny idea that that would be the case. But and that's not true either. But they are super, super, super detailed images. And so his paintings don't really break down unless you get, you know, almost to a microscopic level. They always look real, incredibly real. And so we have a tendency to want to believe what you see in those pictures, almost as if they're photographs, which they are anything but a photograph. It's a painting, you know, it's completely made up. And so because of the way his work looks. People have wanted to believe that what's in there is real. And so they've looked at this image of two people, a man and a woman, in an interior, and they have a dog. And of course, I always love showing paintings that have dogs in them. So, and I always do if I possibly can. But it's got a dog, and it's got a mirror, and it's got this big, great brass chandelier. And there are all these details, tons and tons and tons of details. And so everyone kind of has a stab at this. And there's a very early sort of understanding of it as a marriage portrait, and that the two people in this room are being married. And it happens fairly early on in a written inventory. It's described as a marriage portrait. So then you have all of these scholars who are trying to figure out what kind of marriage this is and how could this be happening and what is it. So there have been decades and decades of scholars who've been trying to approach it in terms of a marriage portrait. But in fact, it doesn't look like that is what it is anymore. And it is something else entirely. And so in my talk, I'm going to kind of take people through the process of how do you break down old myths and start to see something anew? And I think that's one of the great challenges. You asked earlier about challenges. Trying to see a picture that is so intensely familiar in a new way is a tremendous challenge for art historians. And that's one of the things that you have to do with a picture like this or the Mona Lisa that I'm going to show. And so how do you see something as if you've never seen it before? And that's kind of the process, too, that I'll take people through.
Next, Gelfand describes the major Renaissance artists, starting with Leonardo da Vinci, who she describes as a very quirky character.
The way that I always look at kind of the big three of the Renaissance, because you've got Leonardo, and I am going to talk very briefly about him in my talk, but, you know, you've got, he's working after my guy, Jan van Eyck, is dead. So he's not really a direct influence on him, but he certainly does influence everybody afterwards in some ways. He's odd. So you've got Leonardo, and then you've got Michelangelo, and then you've got Raphael. And I always play with the three of them when I teach Renaissance, Italian Renaissance art, because they're such different personalities. And so you've got Raphael, who is incredibly charming and was very, very handsome and incredibly successful. And his work is kind of this almost mix of Leonardo's perfection mixed with kind of the muscularity of Michelangelo. And they're really, really beautiful images. And he dies young, so there's a kind of romantic story about him. And then you've got Michelangelo, who is this like highly muscular, very masculine guy who's making sculptures and making paintings and making buildings and highly, highly productive and really neurotic. Like, you know, we have all of these letters from him and his diaries, and he's this really neurotic guy. But what he wants is sort of connections with people. He's really interested in people. And then you've got Leonardo, and Leonardo is just, he's just really, really weird. He's not like anybody else. So he, you know, he's the first person we know of who climbed a mountain just to see what it was like up there. And he doesn't seem to ever form any strong bonds with anyone in his entire life. He's really different. You know, he writes this letter to the Duke of Milan. So he's a Florentine, and that's his hometown. And he writes to the Milanese Duke, who is Milan is the enemy of Florence during this period. And he writes to him and he says, hey, you know, you should hire me because I am an engineer and I do this and I do that. And the very end, he says, you know, I can paint a little bit. But what he, and he, so he obviously thinks of himself as sort of painter last and everything else first. But his letter to the Duke, he basically says, you know, I figured out a way that we could flood the entire city of Florence, you know, and it's like, that's his hometown. That's a really odd thing to propose to the enemy of your hometown. He's a really, really strange guy. And I think that what he's doing is so far outside the mainstream that, you know, his influence is certainly there, but probably more so in painting than anywhere else. You know, we all know about his flying machines and all of that, and the fact that, you know, the only reason they didn't work, it seems to be, is because there was no power for them. If he'd had a power source, they probably would have worked. But, you know, I think his legacy, to me at least, and maybe it's just because I'm an art historian, is really in terms of painting and the fact that the designs he came up with and his ideas become so widespread, especially in Italian Renaissance painting and then moving on from there. But in a lot of ways, I see him as sort of an outlier. And that Raphael is really, he's the one that kind of takes the Renaissance and moves it forward in an accessible way. You know, neither Leonardo nor Michelangelo nor Jan van Eyck, who I work on, are really accessible role models for most artists. So there's an interesting problem there.
Oh, very interesting. And what is it about the Renaissance, and what really defined that transition into the Renaissance, and that those paintings that depicted the natural world? And
you know, it's an interesting question. I had a teacher, I loved this professor actually when I was at Williams, who said that the Renaissance was the most medieval thing the Middle Ages ever came up with, which I always think is a really great way to think about them, is as some sort of continuity with the medieval period. So the Northern Renaissance, the artists that I focus on, they really do kind of continue a lot of medieval ideas, but melding them with greater observation. And clearly there are two things, I think, that are happening at the same time. You've got artists who are increasingly able to do that, and the invention of oil painting is a tremendous help in terms of that, and that impacts both sides of the Alps. But you've got that, but you've also got the desire on the part of individuals to have work, to commission work that looks more naturalistic. So those two things are going together. If the patrons didn't want things that looked realistic, you wouldn't have artists creating them. So the two things have to kind of go hand in hand. And the period that I think that most people tend to think of as, you know, the High Renaissance is really, really short. It's from about 1500 to 1520. It happens primarily in Florence and in Rome. And it is really an outlier. If you're going to look at the whole continuity of the history of art, that 20-year period, you know, it's very influential, but it is an outlier. It's exceptional. And so it's a hard thing to kind of deal with in terms of what its overall, you know, long-term impact is. I think your question is a complicated question, is what I'm saying. I wish there was an easy answer for that. You know, there are a lot of other things I could bring up, too. I mean, art history is the most interdisciplinary of disciplines. And so, you know, I talked a little bit about, you know, patrons and artists and changes in technology allowing artists to create differently. But you've also got this sort of really, you know, a rebirth of interest in classical antiquity. And they start to find, because they're looking for them, they start to find and then really use early antique sources. And they may not understand them, and a lot of them could be fakes, but they start to mine that material and try very hard to kind of not just revive classical antiquity, which had happened many times periodically throughout history, but actually to rival it and surpass it. And that is really the thing that sets that High Renaissance period in Italy apart from any other time.
Dr. Gelfin recommends some modern works that successfully blend the two fields.
Actually, we have a great show that's up right now at the Nora Eccles Harrison Museum of Art, which I am also the interim executive director of right now. And that show is really wonderful. It just opened. I would encourage everybody to go see it. It'll be up throughout the year. And it's called Looks, and it's about contemporary artists dealing with light primarily, but also color. And we have some wonderful objects in that. The one that really kind of sticks out to me is Robert Irwin, and we have an Irwin disc. It's just an amazing thing that the museum has that. There are a handful of them in museums across the country. And it is really an artist kind of playing with what was a new material. So all of those, he made it in the 60s, and it was he was a Los Angeles artist, and Irwin was thinking about perception and light. And so it's a disc that sticks out from the wall. It's made out of essentially plexi. It's made out of a polymer. And when you light it the way you're supposed to, which we've done, it looks, you can't tell where it is. It disappears and turns into shadow, and it turns into light, and you don't know really what you're seeing. And it's a fantastic experience to look at that. And that, to me, you know, these guys were playing with those polymers because there was the whole aerospace industry in Southern California, and they were turning out all of these new products and medium that nobody knew what to do with. And so the artists started playing around with them. And that's a very kind of fun thing to see. In my talk, I'm going to show something by the artist Anish Kapoor, who is a British artist whose work I think is very much about perception. And he has large teams that help. A lot of people have seen his most famous work, which is in Chicago. It's the Cloud Gate, and other people call it the Bean, but that big, fabulous silver sculpture that's in the Millennium Park that really completely alters your perception of the entire city of Chicago, actually, when you're near it. It kind of sucks the city in and alters it, and it alters you, and you become part of that. And it is a perfectly mirrored, enormous thing, and it's gorgeous. And I think that kind of thing is something that I'm really interested in seeing artists play with. I know that my artists also like to play with reflections, and I'll talk about that a little bit with Jan van Eyck. But those ideas of sort of fusing and thinking about perception and new materials and all of that, I think, are key to successful contemporary art.
After Dr. Galpin's talk tonight at 7, attendees are invited to participate in hands-on learning activities for all ages. Join the conversation tonight in the Emory Auditorium, Room 130 of the Eccles Science Learning Center. Sherry Quinn, Access Utah.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by the USU Kane College of the Arts, welcoming Dr. Jenny Doctor, specialist in 20th century British musical culture. More information is available online. More information is online at music.usu.edu/events or 797-8022.
Utah Public Radio now makes it even easier to stay up to date with News at Noon on Twitter. This is April Ashland, UPR's social media coordinator, inviting you to follow and join the conversation about politics, local, and statewide events by going to twitter.com/UtahPublicRadio.
Support for Science Questions comes from the College of Science at Utah State University, where students step beyond the classroom, participating in advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
T-minus 20 seconds. T-minus 15 seconds.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Elaine Taylor.
And this is Sherry Quinn.
And I'm Susie Montgomery.
And I'm intern Clint Holgate.
Today, we explore the technology used to get us to space and current satellite research.
Starting with SQ Radio's recent visit to a rocket launch near Promontory, Utah.
After driving through what seemed like the middle of nowhere, we arrived to the headquarters of Alliant Tech Systems. ATK, a major supplier of aerospace and defense products, recently tested a GEM 60 rocket motor on their test range in northeastern Utah.
But before we launch into the details, let's look back on the history of rockets. The first recorded use of rockets dates from 1232 BCE, when the Chinese attached tubes filled with gunpowder to arrows and launched them at invading Mongols.
600 years later, we hear Francis Scott Key mention a rocket's red glare in the Star-Spangled Banner. However, in order to find a rocket that you'd recognize, we would have to jump way forward into the late 20th century, when a Russian school teacher by the name of Konstantin Tsiolkovsky published a paper proposing that the best way to get a rocket into space would be the use of liquid propellant.
It wouldn't be until 1942, at the height of the Second World War, that this technology would successfully launch a V-2 missile into outer space.
Up here on the left, we're going to pass a control bunker. This is where the whole test is initiated from. So that's the closest any humans are to the test.
Back at ATK, we're headed towards the untested rocket. The area is a maze of roads and gravel firebreaks surrounded by hills of dry grass. We're ensured the ATK has their own emergency response team if anything goes wrong, or if the hillside catches fire, which apparently isn't that uncommon.
The GEM 60 is part of a system that the United Launch Alliance uses to launch some incredibly important payloads to the safety and security of the United States.
The GEM stands for Graphite Epoxy Motor, and the 60 is the diameter in inches of the rocket motor. The GEM was first developed in 1990 as an alternative to the heavier and weaker steel motors that were common at the time.
Because the GEM is lighter, it can be made larger to hold more fuel, thus allowing it to more efficiently propel heavier payloads into space. We spoke with engineer Jeff Nostrom.
Why is it important to do ground tests?
You gain a lot of information. The ground test gives you your performance requirements so that you know how much weight you can boost into space. And so that's what we gain from the ground test is performance limits.
ATK performs these ground tests year-round, primarily to ensure that new products are up to their standards or to make sure that production is consistent.
Although the GEM 60 was first developed in 2000, it has recently undergone changes to its manufacturing that warrant new tests. ATK took over the production of the nozzle used on the bottom of the booster and has a new supplier for the rayon used in the manufacturing process.
Though these changes are small, they may inadvertently affect the reliability of the rocket booster.
To test these changes, ATK implemented what is called a static cold temperature ground test, where the core of the rocket is chilled to 30 degrees Fahrenheit and the booster is strapped to a concrete test stand.
Meaning that it doesn't actually launch into the air?
Yep.
We've chilled this motor down. Why is that important?
By making it cold, it's a slower burning material, and so the slower burning material puts the most stress on the nozzle.
And what happens is when you have a cold temperature launch, the chemistry, as it burns, it causes it to burn a little bit longer. You've got a very, very hot flame and a lot of pressure and mass flow coming out of the nozzle. If that burns longer, that nozzle's got to be able to withstand the greater burn time.
That was Jeff Nostrom and Halsey Murdoch, who is Director of Strategy and Business Development at ATK.
So if we can withstand this cold temperature burn, we are going to be good for every other launch condition that ULA will need to launch in. Reliability is one of the key factors for the GEM 60. Although we don't have men and women flying on the top of this rocket, we have things that are almost as important to the security of the country. So this rocket has to be very, very reliable.
GEM 60 boosters are primarily used on the Delta IV M-plus launch vehicles, which propel global positioning, weather, and government satellites into Earth's orbit.
GEM 60 seemed enormous, but I was assured by the ATK spokeswoman, Trina Hellquist, that the booster is considered small. Okay, here's a few stats. The GEM 60 is 53 feet long, which is about the length of a semi-truck, and the fuel alone weighs over 65,000 pounds. It produces 270,000 pounds of force and burns at 2,000 degrees.
Okay, back to the launch.
You're going to see a flash, and you'll see the flame come out, and the rocket motor plume come out. And you might say, "Well, that's not very impressive."
Six,
that's because you haven't heard the sound yet.
4, 3, 2, 1, fire.
Everything seemed to go well then.
So far, it looks great. We'll hear from the test conductor shortly to make sure the motor met the performance, but everything looked really good. Great, so.
After the launch, we visited the test site, which had just been cooled with water. The test, which was a success, left the nozzle blackened and the area stinking of burned fireworks. Although the results were positive, the future of the space industry is still uncertain. Government funding of new research in space has been cut in recent years, and companies like ATK have felt it.
By producing the GEM 60 nozzles in-house, ATK is able to create some level of job security for its employees. Even so, the company has had to cut back.
We're certainly as lean as we can possibly be. We're planning on where we would potentially have to move if there are cuts made. Or when I say move, what kinds of changes we'd have to make. So that's what we worry about when we see cuts in the future. Now,
even with all of the cutbacks, ATK is set to start on a series of projects with NASA. We spoke with Charlie Precourt, the general manager for the Space Launch Division at ATK.
What will ATK be involved in with NASA coming up?
We have three major contract efforts underway right now. The key one is to develop the flight hardware for the first test flights of the Space Launch System, which is the heavy lift launch vehicle for beyond low Earth orbit exploration.
And when will they hope that these flights actually go into space?
The first test flight is scheduled for 2017. And then the other thing we're doing is a new contract to develop an advanced booster under a NASA research announcement, which will create even more capability than our current five-segment booster. And then finally, the other contract that's of interest would be the abort system for the Orion. We are subcontract to Lockheed to develop that system.
These new contracts have provided ATK with what Murdoch describes as a defined future. However, any reduction to the funding of the commercial or defense budgets will have a negative effect on the industry.
All of aerospace has seen issues, whether it's DOD, NASA or other government agencies that use aerospace and aerospace manufacturers. There's been a pressure from a budgetary standpoint on all of us, and we need to a cycle in the economy back to an upswing would be a big thing for all of us. No doubt about it.
So these rockets boost satellites into space, but why should the public have a vested interest in the space industry? And what do everyday people get out of new space technologies?
Everything that we have in today's microwaves, medicine, all of those things come from the space research. All of those type of items, the better X-rays, the better computers, all stem from the NASA and going to space the first time. So it's exponential what you get from the space exploration.
Well, it's been proven countless times that advancements in technology reap multiple rewards to the economy and to our nation, both from an economic competitive standpoint as well as from a benefit to the people in the country in terms of everyday capabilities.
The future of the space industry remains up in the air, but the benefits to society seem obvious, and those in the industry remain positive.
For more information about the history of rockets and the space industry, visit NASA.gov.
And to learn more about the GEM 60 and future ground tests, visit ATK.com.
Thanks, Elaine and Clint. Satellites are the main payload on rockets like the GEM 60, and these days, small satellites are a big deal. Every year, hundreds of scientists and engineers from across the world attend the Small Satellite Conference in Logan.
Innovations presented at this meeting are so valuable, even the U.S. military takes notice. There, I recently caught up with Captain Paul Stewart, director of the Naval Research Laboratory, and USU's Space Dynamics Lab Director of Technology, starting in October. He explains the importance of small satellites to the Navy.
One of the areas where we are leading today and continue to lead is in space sciences. The studying of the Sun-Earth system and how the magnetosphere, ionosphere are affected by the Sun. That is a very large area that's going to affect all of our commercial satellites. It's going to affect DoD satellites, and we need to be very understanding of how to model that. And so the question should come next is, why is the Navy so concerned about space? Well, we use more space assets than anybody else because we are a Navy. We are deployed. We are way out there. And so we need over-the-horizon communications. We need satellite comms. We need accurate navigation. And so we rely far more than terrestrial services like the Air Force and the Marines. For us, we are one of the biggest users and will always be as long as we are out there in front and being expeditionary.
Veteran aerospace engineer Gil Moore co-founded the Small Satellite Conference. From college students to high-level Department of Defense officials, everyone knows Gil Moore. His enthusiasm for space technology is infectious, and his mentorship and support has been instrumental to aerospace education and to numerous space missions. Here's a clip from a story I produced for Voice of America in 2006, where Gil Moore helped sponsor a student rocket launch competition in Green River, Utah.
It's the silent part of our military capability that keeps us safe and allows us to wage quick, decisive, minimum collateral damage war that sets us apart from all other nations. The weather imagery or knowing about meteors that are coming in, you know, possible asteroid impacts of the Earth that would wipe out all known civilization and so on. All that information is why it's important to go into space.
Hey, you're okay right now. Wait a minute, you got a call.
One of his projects includes POPAX, short for Polar Orbiting Passive Atmospheric Calibration Sphere. This is a collaborative mission that includes Morehead State University, the University of Arkansas, Planetary Systems Corporation, and Montana State University to assess changes in the density of the upper atmosphere in response to heightened solar activity. The launch is sponsored by the Air Force, and they will hitch a ride on Space Exploration's Falcon 9 rocket in 2013.
The scientific goal is to find out how the sun influences the upper atmosphere of the Earth during its quiet times and its noisy times throughout an 11-year solar cycle or two. And we've been doing this kind of thing, the United States, well, the world has, for a long time. And one of the simple ways to find out how eruptions on the sun change the density of the upper atmosphere of the Earth and thus satellite orbits is to just put balls up there and track them. They're nice and smooth and they're round and it doesn't matter what direction they face, they're going to have the same drag like you throw a baseball. That's basically a test of atmospheric density because it slows down by the time it gets from the pitcher's hand to the catcher. And then we track them with radar, the Air Force does. And they determine the orbit of the satellite. And then as the orbit changes, it changes because as it comes down, this is an elliptical orbit. The satellite spends most of its time way out outside the atmosphere. And then every 100 minutes or so, it comes dipping down into the sensible atmosphere where there is drag, where there are enough molecules up there to change the energy of the satellite. And so we'll track it with radar and determine the orbit of the satellite and then observe the change when the atmosphere is just nice and quiet in between solar storms. And then the information from the radar tracking will be fed to student observers all over the world who have telescopes that can be used to photograph the satellite later.
There are approximately 1,000 operating satellites orbiting the Earth right now. And when the sun essentially burps or has an eruption, the orbits of the satellites in low Earth orbit are changed.
And sometimes the effect is so strong, the atmosphere can change by a factor of 1,000 at those orbital altitudes. And the orbits can be disturbed enough that the Space Command, who has to track all that stuff up there, including all the space junk, lose track of it. And then they have to go find all this junk again. And that's a pain. That's really tough. With these little spheres giving them calibration information, they can predict what's going to happen better, more accurately, more quickly, and thus keep track of those constellations. And one of the reasons they track all that stuff up there is to know when the junk might collide with the space station, for example, or with a Falcon 9 going up there, or lots of military assets that are in this general region. And so this is just a way of getting their data to be more precise and their prediction codes better.
And then how often does the sun burp?
The sun has a sunspot cycle. You get more dots on the sun every 11 years. And then you go through 5.5 years, you go through a quiet period of solar minimum. Not much is going on. Then when you get back to solar maximum, the sun starts throwing out these coronal mass ejections much more frequently. Now, we've only had a couple of them so far in this solar cycle. This is a pretty quiet cycle. This solar max is not really very exciting. I was hoping there'd be a lot more stuff going on. So during maybe along about next March or April, when we're right at solar max 24 peak, you might see CMEs every week. And on the downslope of the cycle, as it heads to solar minimum, there are frequent eruptions. And even during solar minimum, you can have big whams every once in a while, but they're much, much less frequent.
And how massive are these?
Way, way, way more than the weight of the Earth. I mean, but they are ionized particles. They've had the electrons stripped away by the heat of the, you know, they're down in the sun to start with. And when this eruption occurs, the stuff gets thrown away from the sun, and it naturally cools as it goes away. It may start out at 10 million degrees temperature, the individual atoms that have been stripped, their ions now. And you can have anything from hydrogen. See, the sun is a big ball of hydrogen converting itself to helium, mostly. And then there are lots of other elements are formed in stars. And the sun is a typical star, a small one. So you can have iron nuclei coming out from the sun. Those are really energetic particles, and they create significant disturbances up there. Now, by the way, before you ask, this stuff doesn't get down to the surface of the Earth, so it doesn't bother us. All this activity is fairly esoteric, but the ionosphere of the Earth is significantly disturbed. Radio communications get fouled up. These energetic particles can, in commercial satellites that are not protected particularly well, their electronics can be destroyed during some of these events. Solar cells degrade. The solar cells we have up there to power the satellites significantly get degraded during a solar event. So one of the things you'd like to be able to do is to say, okay, here comes a solar flare, and you see it, and you can measure its intensity, and you can get a pretty good feel for how big a coronal mass ejection eruption may follow that flare. And so what you can do is to tell the people who have satellites up there, turn your satellites so that now your solar arrays are parallel to the path of the incoming particles, and they get a lot less damage. Okay, that's one of the things you can do. You tell the astronauts, hey guys, go to a particular place in the station where there's a lot of absorbing material so you don't get really whammed. And you can also tell the people who operate power grids on the Earth, where they have big generators running all over the world, and they share their power, like from Canada and the U.S. have cooperative networks. Those grids can be seriously damaged and have been in past solar cycles. 11 years ago and 22 years ago, we had big eruptions that really created havoc. And all of the northeastern United States and Montreal and Toronto and so on were blacked out because there's a thing called an electromagnetic pulse or an EMP. When this CME comes racing in, that will induce a huge surge of current in our power grids. Now, if you don't know about it, what it can do is it can pop all the breakers in your big distribution network. We're in a particular one here called the Bonneville network, and it can shut down Salt Lake City because it pops the breakers and in some cases burns up transformers, and it can burn up lines. I mean, it's just a huge surge of power. However, what you do is there's an ACE satellite sitting out 9/10 of the way from here to the sun, and it says, hey guys, here comes a biggie, look out. And so NASA and the Air Force and everybody else yell at the power companies, and they say, guys, slow your generators down, take the peak loads off your power grid, okay, and in some cases, disconnect your transformers. So you may inconvenience people for a few minutes, but that keeps them from just tearing up the grid. And we've learned over solar cycle after solar cycle after solar cycle how to deal with these things. And so the more we know about solar terrestrial physics, the better off the people on the surface of the Earth are.
A student-driven project at USU Space Dynamics Lab is contributing to our knowledge in this realm. The project called DICE, which stands for Dynamic Ionosphere CubeSat Experiment, consists of two identical spinning spacecraft about the size of a loaf of bread that are orbiting the Earth's upper atmosphere. The goal is to learn more about geomagnetic storms that occur when things like solar flares come off the sun and send off energy in the form of frequency waves. Like Gil Moore said, these eruptions can hit the Earth and disrupt everything from communication satellites to airline navigation to GPS systems. Chad Fish is the DICE program manager.
We're bringing down lots of data from these very small spacecraft, and it's coming down at the Wallops Flight Facility, and then we bring it over the network back to SDL. We store it in our servers here, and then Astra, SDL, and other team members such as Embry-Riddle and Clemson, they also access that database, and the data then goes out and gets disseminated to the space weather community.
And how often are you receiving data? What's the rate?
Every day, Monday through Friday. We ping them, we wake them up, we say, give us your data, they download it, and then we start the cycle for the next day.
Fundamentally, they are trying to understand how solar flares interact with our geomagnetic field from pole to pole on Earth.
And it pushes and pulls on that, and it causes different activities in the upper atmosphere. One very impressive manifestation of that is the aurora that folks see at the northern and southern latitudes. Those very pretty lights are caused by interactions of the sun with the Earth.
There is another benefit to the project, aside from all the space weather data, hands-on education. DICE was the result of a $1.2 million grant from the National Science Foundation in 2009, giving more than a dozen USU engineering students the opportunity to build, test, launch, and collect data from DICE. Graduate student Eric Stromberg continues to work on the project at SDL.
I actually have been involved with a lot of the DICE satellite. I started out doing the mechanical design, all the moving parts and things like that. I moved on from there and helped wind torque coils, hand wind them with wire, and then I moved on to doing integration and testing and doing the program management and writing software for our ground station. So I kind of been involved in a lot of what happened on DICE, which was a great experience.
So I think it's a way to motivate students to really feel like they can contribute and make an impact, and I think it's just a wonderful program.
It's been awesome to learn something in class and be able to physically apply it on actually putting something together and putting together a satellite. And so the cross-correlation between this kind of a project and the education that you're doing, it makes it so that you're not just book smart. You actually understand that, oh, well, in theory, this piece of hardware or whatever might work. But now that we have the ability to actually test it out, and because in the coursework here, we have labs that we put stuff together on. If you have more experience in a very specific area, you can definitely take that experience and bring it back to the coursework. And like for me personally, I mean, homework became a lot easier. A lot of the concepts started making more sense because you can tie them together and get the big picture, not just what you're focusing on in that one class.
This USU student-led effort goes beyond a school science project into the outer space arena, where aerospace technology blooms. It has about 8 more months until mission accomplished.
There's a lot of work to go forward, a lot of science benefit and benefit to the community in general regarding space weather that we expect to come out of this.
Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn, Susie Montgomery, and Elaine Taylor. And we welcome aboard intern and sound engineer Clint Holgate. Thanks for listening.
You know you've had a good day in the office when you hear.
Smells like science.
One of the perks of the job, yeah.
We'll be right back.
Support for Science Questions is provided by Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information is at apogeeinstruments.com.
Regional correspondents on Utah Public Radio provide that unique link that makes UPR's statewide news coverage your favorite resource for news. Hi, I'm Mackenzie Hamilton. Join me each evening during All Things Considered at 5:30 for Expanded Utah News. UPR has a one-of-a-kind network with reporters from Southern Utah, the Uinta Basin, Moab, and Utah County. It's the only way of providing you with the views and news that you need to make informed decisions. Utah Public Radio, your favorite public radio station for statewide Utah news.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. I'm Megan Van Frank. This week, learn about the secret Japanese air attacks on the United States mainland during World War II. First this.
The Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council, with support from a We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation.
The Japanese bombing of Hawaii's Pearl Harbor brought the United States into World War II in 1941. But one of the best-kept secrets of the war was a Japanese air offensive on the U.S. mainland using fire balloon bombs, some of which actually reached Utah. Starting in November 1944, Japan launched 9,000 hydrogen balloons laden with bombs that drifted in the high-altitude jet stream more than 6,000 miles across the Pacific Ocean to North America. Constructed of handmade paper and starch paste, each balloon carried a payload meant to damage cities, farms, and forests. Of the 1,000 balloons thought to have reached North America, fewer than 300 were actually sighted. Most balloons were found along the Pacific coast and in the Intermountain West, but some traveled as far inland as Michigan. 5 balloons are known to have landed in Utah, including 2 reported in Box Elder County and 1 each in Morgan, Duchesne, and Iron counties. Luckily, these did not explode in populated areas, but Box Elder County Sheriff Warren Hyde did acquire a few bruises in his attempt to wrestle one balloon to the ground. The lawman got a free ride when he clung to the balloon's ropes as it drifted and bounced him along for half a mile. The U.S. government prohibited the media from reporting balloon sightings in order to stem public panic and deny Japan information about the impact of their attack. The War Department feared the balloons might carry deadly diseases or even soldiers. It wasn't until 6 people in Oregon were killed by one of the bombs that the government finally confirmed the existence of the fire balloons and warned people to steer clear of them. Other than the Oregon deaths, damage from the fire balloons was minor. Discouraged by the apparent failure of the effort, Japan halted its balloon attacks in April 1945, 4 months before the end of the war. Sources and past episodes of the Beehive Archive may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.
Hi, this is Blair Larson, host of Fresh Folk. On the show this week, I feature the inspiring songs of Laura Herskovich and the fierce and witty songs of Marion Call. I'll also play songs from new albums by Greg Laswell, Nancy Beaudette, and Trip McCool, to name just a few. Join me this Saturday at 8 p.m. for Fresh Folk on Utah Public Radio.
At Utah Public Radio, we discuss current events, social issues, gardening tips, politics, talk with local authors, and many other important Utah-related subjects. On Access Utah, an original program produced by Utah Public Radio, I'm Addison Pace, production intern for Access Utah. Join us weekday mornings 9 to 10, Utah Public Radio, Utah's favorite public radio station, for providing your access to things that matter in Utah.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.